This is ESPN Crick Info.
Hello, 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 and welcome to another edition of Talking T20 with me, Daniel Norcross. And today I am joined, I'm delighted to say, by a returning member of the crew. It's from Crick Info's very own stable of brilliant county writers. It's Matt Roller. Hello.
Hi, Dan. Very nice to be with you.
Lovely to have you here. We're doing it this time from within the confines of my sitting room because I've just got back from Hove, having witnessed the women's KSL finals day, which was quite it's a punishing schedule, not quite as punishing as the men. Two matches take place, one at noon it was yesterday, and then one at four. And it resulted, I'm very pleased to say, as I am somewhat biased, in victory for the Surrey Stars and for my colleague Ebony Rainford Brent, the only full-time director of cricket or women's cricket for a county. So there might be a lesson there. We are going to discuss KSL Finals Day in a little bit more detail later. But first, we're going to go through chronologically the events of a scintillating week, because we've had the quarterfinals of the Vitality T20 Blast this week, and three of them have been low-scoring affairs. One of them, which took place on Monday as a result of a washout, it was postponed as a spare day for the quarterfinals, and resulted in a Somerset win. So we now know the identity of all four finalists for Finals Day on September the 15th. So let us start. Let's go back in time. I'd make that woo-woo-woo music if I had it, but our production values aren't quite that good. Back to what would have been Thursday.
Thursday evening.
Canterbury, Kent playing Lancashire. Now, you've witnessed all of these games.
I have, yeah.
I got to see three of them and was scheduled to see the Taunton game, but unfortunately it got rained off and then I was sent to Hove. So the three games I saw typically were the ones that had virtually no runs in them. The first one, that Kent-Lancashire game, Sam Billings, he didn't take to Twitter, I don't think, on this occasion. Or did he take to Twitter?
I think he, in a post-match interview and then later in another, possibly the day later, called it a snot fest, I think was how he described
it. A snot fest, which is fantastic. I mean, it's a bit harsh, I think, on the groundsman, because what we're looking at here, let's be really clear, that because all the matches are televised, they inevitably play on central pitches for the TV cameras, for Sky. It's perfectly reasonable. And the result is that those pitches are not new. I mean, that may in some way have contributed to these low scores. Other reasons will also have abounded. But it really was not ideal for Kent, was it? Because Kent, I mean, it's not that they're flat track bullies, Matt, but they like the ball coming on, let us say, and it really didn't come on.
Yeah, and especially against a Lancashire team that has, I think midway through the tournament, basically set out its stall to say we're going to bowl a hell of a lot of spin overs. They bowled 52%, I think, of spin overs in the group stage, which is far more than any team.
Nice
and
stat.
It was no surprise, really, to see Messrs. Parkinson and Khan do the business.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's yet again, leggies. It's just been a feature of this whole season, hasn't it? It's a feature of T20 cricket the world over at the moment. But Matt Parkinson is a different kind of leggy. 3 for 27 he took. And he contrasts so fascinatingly with, for example, Rashid Khan, who's so quick through the air and off the pitch. Matt Parkinson's a real flighter of the ball, isn't he? I mean, he picked up, he even got a slip catch.
Yeah.
Not somebody out of a slip catch in a T20 quarterfinal, that's sort of a collector's item almost.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to see the contrast across the quarterfinals as well, because if you looked at Monday's game, you have Max Waller, who has variously been ribbed by commentators, pundits, journalists and his own teammates about the fact he's not really a leggy because he doesn't really turn the ball very much. And, you know, he's a guy that will bowl at 55, 60 miles an hour. And then you've got Parkinson, who was bowling 44, 43 miles an hour at some points and really tossing it up and sort of letting the pitch do the work in the way that someone like Adil Rashid used to do for England. But now he obviously bowls quicker and shorter and faster. And it's interesting to see the contrast between a young leggy plying their trade and learning the art of wrist spin. And trying to find that consistency in length and...
Well, and the conditions are perfect for him as well, weren't they? Because if you're going to be that kind of a slower through the air, lots of wheels on a ball, then actually the snot fest, as Sam Billings so eloquently described it, was sort of ideal for him, wasn't it? I mean, it was such a claggy kind of performance from Kent. Really disappointing in front of their own crowd. I put out a tweet, which I feel a little bit guilty about, that the crowd was very quiet. But they were. I mean, it wasn't really that much of an occasion. And I suppose in part that was because the cricket itself wasn't, you know, hugely appealing. But to a degree, you know, sometimes when you get down to these quarterfinals, you're looking at the eight best teams, or the teams that perform best at any rate. And those teams frequently are the ones who've got the strongest bowling attacks, because if you've got a consistent bowling attack, that can actually work for you game after game after game. It, as we've seen in the IPL, if you cram your side full of explosive batters, I'm afraid if they come off one in every two games, that means that, you know, half the games they're not coming off. So you can easily be losing those ones. Whereas your bowling attack, as we saw, you know, with Sussex in the competition, they won five of their last six games, was it? Or in six of the last seven, something insane. That kind of consistency can come into it. And the result is often that you're going to get lower scoring games, it seems to me, that combined with the pitches. But you've got to hand it to Lancashire. I mean, Jos Buttler came back. Was he stumped off a wide without facing a ball again? That's my favourite trope of the season. And it's one of those classic things, isn't it? You know, they come back from England duty, everyone's looking forward to it. Ball things out instantly. But, you know, you've got to keep wicket. And Lancashire, I don't think they're a particularly fashionable side, but they're coming into good form just when they need to.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how they go on finals day, because they've clearly set up in a way that suits slow and low pitches, turning pitches. They don't necessarily have the batting power that some of the other semi-finalists do. And also, it'll of course be interesting to note whether or not Messrs. Buttler and Jennings will be back for finals day. Because in the absence of Buttler and Jennings, they'll probably have Carl Brown and either Danny Lamb or Josh Bohannon or one of the, you know, perfectly good county cricketers, but lacking the star quality.
You'd think they would be back. I mean, the last test ends on the 11th. It would be, I mean, Lancashire are desperately going to want those players back, because they're fighting a relegation struggle in the county championship, apart from anything else. So they're going to want to get those players back in the side. The Sri Lanka tour, I suppose, is relatively soon after the end of the season, isn't it? Middle of October. But for batsmen, it's less significant, isn't it, to get rest, wouldn't you think?
Yeah, I imagine that the ECB will put those players back in, and especially, I mean, I think realistically, who are we talking about? We're talking Moeen Ali, Buttler, Jennings. Is that pretty much it out of the test squad?
It feels like it, yeah, and because Yorkshire, who supply most of England's team, are not at finals day, or indeed in the quarterfinals.
I'd like to think from the ECB's point of view, they'll put those guys back in there. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see how Lancashire go. I don't think they're necessarily the most fancy team. I think Sussex are probably favourites going into that marginally. But equally, they're playing against the Worcestershire team that maybe don't have the knockout experience that some other teams do. And will also be missing Callum Ferguson. He's flying back to Australia before finals day.
Yeah.
I think that'll be an interesting first game.
Liam Livingstone, might he make it back? I know he's got a...
I think there's a chance.
Yeah, because he's had a pretty severe injury, but it was quite a while ago now. And I think there's talk that he might be fit and available. He's a man that could make a difference, because that's one of the things that they look like they're lacking, is a really explosive batsman in the middle order. Jordan Clark, they can still put in. I mean, he was rested from the county championship game against Surrey, which was rather intriguing, having been signed for Surrey for next year. But there was talk of a bit of a hamstring tweak there. So he gives them something, but they could do with a bit of explosion, couldn't they, for finals day?
Yeah, it's interesting as well that they're playing the first game, because I think that'll probably marginally suit Worcestershire better, because you'd probably say that batting is Worcester's strong suit, whereas bowling is probably Lancashire's strong suit. And typically the way finals day goes is the first game is reasonably high scoring and it becomes a slower wicket as the day wears on, as you pretty much expect. But equally, if this year, for whatever reason, we've seen quite a few pitches across the country be slightly more tired as the season has worn on, probably due to the heat wave. If that is a slower wicket at Edgbaston, that'll definitely suit Lancs more.
Quick word on Kent, because they've had a good season, really. And they scraped into a home quarter-final. I think Gloucestershire were probably favourites to get a home quarter-final. We didn't quite manage it. They've had a good season, though, haven't they? They rely to a degree on the likes of Joe Denley, especially because he provides them with leg spin and opening batting potential. But did they fall short because they rely a little bit too much on their batsmen coming off, and in a one-off game that can you know, that could be your downfall.
I think perhaps, I think as much as anything, they just misread conditions on the day. I think on that pitch, 155, 160 would probably have been a par score. And I think they probably have a team that could quite feasibly have done to that, but they tried to go a little bit too hard too soon.
That's a feature actually of all the first three, isn't it? Let's take a look at the Durham game, which happened next. This is particularly brilliant punishing scheduling from the ECB. We understand the reasons, and sometimes there's nothing you can do about it, but people had to go from Canterbury up to Durham and then down to Worcester. Worcester doesn't have floodlights, which is part of the reason they would have to play at the weekend if they were going to get a day game in, of course, not to have an evening game. So off trooped all the Sky cameras and a number of people to go pretty much the whole length of the country to see actually another pretty unremarkable match, I'd say. Now, let's preface this by saying that the Vitality T20 Blast this year has been the highest scoring T20 competition in the history of T20 competitions, hasn't it? It's faster scoring than the IPL. I say highest scoring, it's faster scoring than CPL, BBL, IPL. And yet these first three quarterfinals all followed the same script, side batting first, either misread conditions or just that difficulty of when you play on a slow pitch, trying to push the envelope, trying to get the 160, 170. Those three scores were between 133, weren't they, and 143, I think.
Those yeah, 133 and 140, it was very similar.
It was, it was frighteningly similar. I think that you can exonerate Durham slightly more easily because they are up against a supreme bowling attack. I know you want to talk about a couple of players in that side. We've talked about it a bit on this programme. For my money, possibly the best bowling attack in the world in T20 competitions, especially when Rashid Khan is playing, but had a very able replacement in Will Beer, whose figures this week were 2-17 in 4, which is not shabby when that's your replacement for the number one T20 bowler in the world. And they were just undone, weren't they, by the power of Mills, Jordan, Jofra Archer, Will Beer, and the man I know you want to talk about, Danny Briggs.
Yeah, I mean, I think the interesting thing about this Sussex attack is that while there's been the odd game, which has obviously been dominated by Mills and Rashid, and you can't take anything away from Rashid, he's probably the best bowler in world cricket in terms of T20 just at the moment. I think the interesting thing is just how well Beer in the games he's been in the team, which is only a couple, and then specifically Briggs has done, because you'd expect in a team with Mills, Archer, Jordan, they had David Vesas bowled a few overs as well, that it would be those the seamers who have made all the absolutely. difference. But you know, the Hove pitches haven't necessarily suited the way Sussex play, and they've often been better on the road, and then Briggs and Beer have both been excellent in terms of not only holding up an end but keeping wickets. And I think you mentioned I wanted to speak about Danny Briggs, because since 2010, when he made his debut for Hampshire, he's been unbelievably consistent in terms of not only taking wickets but also keeping things tight. I think he's had basically one season in English T20 cricket where he's gone at above 7.5 runs an over, which was 2016, his first season at Sussex.
Good grief, Jared Kim is going to be all over this.
But other than that, his first season he took the second most wickets in history in a single T20 competition in England, where he took 31 in 2010 as an 18 or 19 year old. And since then he's gone 23, 7, 18, 21, 18, 7, 13, 15 so far this season. And all of those, bar one, are an economy rate between 6-ish and 7.5-ish, which is a pretty remarkable.
Well, that is remarkable. And actually, looking at the results, I'm only half joking, but looking at the results of the St. Lucia Stars, no longer the St. Lucia Zooks, we should point out, their performance director could actually do with the injection of somebody half decent in their bowling attack, because they are getting played to all parts at the moment. That is pretty remarkable, isn't it?
Yeah, and he's also a guy who is realistically, I mean, he flirted with the England team for a few years, I think, when Peter Moores was head coach. But realistically, he's not a guy who's going to force his way into the international setup anytime soon. He's a quick spinner. He bowls sort of 55, 57 mile an hour. Doesn't turn the ball much, but has just found a formula that works really well in white ball cricket at this level.
And skippers when Luke Ryan doesn't.
So, exactly.
You know, he's obviously got a cricket brain on him as well, knows exactly what he's doing, knows his game inside out, as if Sussex actually needs somebody else that can do that. One thing I would suggest to Sussex, I mean, if you're going to just do a little tweak here and there with Sussex, Their one area where they can look a bit vulnerable is the first four or five overs, which is a bit strange when you consider their options with that new ball, the Mills, Archer and Jordan. And yet they quite frequently find themselves, you know, conceding 10, 12 and over in the first four and then dragging it back. I wonder if there's a case for them utilising the likes of Danny Briggs or Will Beer in the power play a bit more than they currently do. Is that a thought?
Yeah, I think that's very reasonable. They quite often, this was a phenomenon that has been written about a couple of times. I think either Jared or Tim Wigmore wrote a piece for Crick Info about it about 18 months ago, where teams have a specialist for the first over, and Sussex this year have done that with David Visa, and he's almost always taken the new ball and quite often will end with one over for six or seven runs, and that's him done.
Work if you can get it.
Yeah, exactly. I think Mills is obviously a guy who is, when someone bowls 95 miles an hour and is a little bit erratic, as Tyler Mills has become in the past 18 months or so, a team could be 30 for three after four overs, in which case
he's done his job,
miles ahead in the game, or
he just looks a different bowler at the death, you know, his variations come through at the death. I just think sometimes, especially on tired wickets, again, you know, if the ball is coming onto you and it's coming at 90 miles an hour, then you can get suddenly a little bit of a lift where otherwise you wouldn't have got it. Maybe if they played a bit more street smart in that first three or four overs, they would be truly unbeatable. They were, though, in the end, pretty much unbeatable. And there's another guy at Sussex we need to talk about. He joined us on commentary, actually, at Hove for the BBC. Laurie Evans averages a tick over 79. 79.14, I think, 554 runs. Absolutely extraordinary. Highest averaging Englishman in the tournament. He's the second highest averaging player after Aaron Finch, who's way out ahead with an average of over 120-odd. So, let's talk briefly about him, because he really impresses me. When he first came on the scene, he was at Surrey and then he went to Warwickshire. A very flamboyant player. Everybody could sort of picture in your mind the classic Laurie Evans drive, beautifully timed, really stylish, sort of like a kind of mini Ian Bell in a way, but a little bit more explosive. What he's become is a really intelligent cricketer. And in a side like Sussex, where they don't have too many big ball strikers, there's another we'll come on to in a moment, Delray Rawlins, who's come into the side at the back end of this season. But in the absence of putting Jofra Archer up the order, for example, they need somebody around whom people can have a dart. So Phil Salt, who's been in and out of form, can go for it. It's safe in the knowledge that, you know, Laurie Evans can just be the glue. And in that match against Durham, it would have been easy to panic. Salt was out second ball, four of the first ball, then caught by Ben Stokes on the second ball. And you could imagine on a slow pitch, in freezing cold conditions, by the way, the temperature dropped to 5 degrees in Durham towards the end of that match. Mark Butcher was being hit by what he claimed was snow. We think it's a bit of hail. It were horrible conditions for batting, fielding and watching cricket. And they could easily actually have panicked there, but they didn't, because Laurie Evans, wise old head, he's about 30-odd, batted through the innings pretty much. 63, I think he got off 47. It was really, really impressive, mature stuff, wasn't it?
Yeah, he's a guy who's come on leaps and bounds in the past couple of seasons, really. I mean, Sussex, to an extent, have a habit of this, where someone like Evans, who probably came to the club when he was, 26, 27, 28, that sort of stage in his career where he probably risked not fulfilling the potential that he clearly had. He's clearly a very capable batsman and an impressive stroke maker. You know, you see one of his lofted extra cover drives or something like that, and it's really
it's dreamy,
it's stylish. But equally, this season he scored a strike rate, I think it's 138, something like that. It's a shade under 140, which isn't going, you know, you wouldn't look at that and say in a league where the runs per over has been 8.5 or something, it doesn't look that impressive. But equally, you know, he scored a lot of runs, he's not out very often. He scores a strike rate that's slightly quicker than the rate at which Sussex concede runs.
That's the key point, isn't it? When you're playing for a side that's got a bowling attack like that, what you need is someone intelligent in that middle order. Middle order, he's coming in at three. I guess in a way, because the bowler's given that licence to be a bit more intelligent, but not everybody is, you know. A lot of people see ball, hit ball. And Delray Rawlins, as we mentioned earlier, is a great example of that. You wouldn't necessarily say he was a thinking cricketer. He plays shots that are quite extraordinary. There was a straight drive that was doing the rounds on Twitter If you got to see it on the TV at the time, it was just gasp-inducingly brilliant. He favours the leg side, not that surprisingly. Tonks it over deep mid-wicket. He's got incredible power. I saw him out in Barbados. You told me that in his all-time international 11, he picked Dwayne Leverock, which we think might be the only man to have done so.
I reckon so. Obviously, he's got his Bermudan links, but I think Rawlins is a really interesting one as well, because he was a guy who, I mean, I remember at the start of the tournament, you were saying it'll be interesting to see how the guys at the ECB lights from that North-South series, how they go in this tournament. And he was out of the team at the start because Sussex signed Tom Bruce, the Kiwi international. Mm. And he had a miserable tournament. I think his top score was about 20 and he scored 70-odd runs in the tournament. And then Rawlins, who I guess has kind of been thought of as maybe a number six, a batting all-rounder. He bowls a bit of fairly filthy left-arm spin.
It's quite effective, filth, but it's not aesthetically pleasing.
No. Yeah, and they backed him. They put him in at number four or five most games and he's impressed in a winning team.
He really has. I mean, I think he's got a talent that's going to go a very long way as well. He's a man for the big occasion. He loves the cameras. It's always a bit concerning when people love the cameras because you think, can't they just play consistently like that all the time? I don't think you need to worry too much in the case of Rawlins. He's got oodles of talent. From the moment you see him, you can just tell. You know, there are times when you're at a game and you see somebody play shots that makes you sit up. You know that, you know, that is out of the ordinary. If he can marshal his talent, I think he will be a very exciting player. And, you know, come the end of this World Cup cycle, which will end in England in 2019, there probably will be a bit of tinkering with the England side. And at that point, it's going to be players like Archer, perhaps, if he's qualified for England. Rawlins are definitely going to be in the minds of the England selectors, you'd think.
Yeah, I see no reason why not, particularly. He's as we say, a clean strike of the ball offers another option with the ball. And, you know, it'll be interesting to see what path England go down after that 2019 World Cup, because there'll be a World T20 sort of in view, but still far enough away that they can regenerate to some extent. But equally, there'll be questions as to whether they want to, depending probably on how two knockout games go. And suddenly a question marks about who captains the side. I think it's quite feasible that Joss Butler will become white ball captain in both formats after 2019. I don't know if you agree with that.
Yeah, you heard it here first. I wouldn't be too surprised. I mean, I'm not actually writing Owen Morgan's obituary yet, because if England do very well, it might revivify him. But by the same token, you could sort of see that as the culmination of a life's work, couldn't you? If England do well in that World Cup, he might think now's a good time in sort of classic tradition to bow out at the top.
Yeah, and then equally, I mean, Morgan's been a guy, whenever England have lost an ODI in the past 2 years, probably he's been, there's a lot of people who are very willing to make him a scapegoat. So,
yeah, well, a part of it, I think, actually, is that a lot of people, armchair selectors, think that England have got too many batsmen, so they want to drop somebody. So Morgan is the one that always is the one they want to make way of. You know, they want to get rid of Morgan so that they can actually fit all of the batting talent that they think is there. Forgetting, of course, that Owen Morgan is England's leading ODI run scorer. I mean, it's quite amazing how people conveniently forget these facts. So, Sussex are through, we've established. Lancashire are through. Third game, which followed again, it was a bit Groundhog Day-ish, down at Worcester, followed a very similar pattern. Side batting first, Gloucestershire made, how many was it in the end?
136.
136, which felt too little at the time. Despite actually giving Worcestershire a bit of a scare with the ball, because they, again, have got a fabulous bowling attack for those sorts of conditions. Benny Howe bowled very well. What I was sad to see was not enough Kieran Nima-Barnett.
Well, he was injured, wasn't he? So it was
a tragedy.
It was actually a big miss. Gloucestershire are a side who have struggled a little bit with injuries this year. Benny Howe was out for a little bit at the start of the tournament. And they kind of just looked a player or two short with the bat. They had Ryan Higgins coming in at five. Jack Taylor, who's had such a great tournament and such a great reinvention as a batsman, was bowled by a real rank long hop.
Well, that was in our leggy watch series. Yeah. That was Brett D'Oliveira taking 4 for 26 with one of the worst balls of the week. And his look of astonishment and slight embarrassment when he took the wicket was absolutely priceless, wasn't it?
Yeah, he had
the
a great
ball
interview.
Virtually yorked the middle stump on the second bounce. It was quite extraordinary.
He had a great interview on TV afterwards where he was deeply, deeply embarrassed to be having been put up to media duties, having bowled a pretty horrible spell of leg spin. But
well, there were two catches on the mid-wicket boundary. There was one at long on. And there's nothing wrong with that, by the way. You know, the boundaries are there for a reason. If the batsman doesn't clear it, then the bowler's taken perfectly legitimate wickets. But, you know, it wasn't Matt Parkinson getting somebody caught at slip. It was Brett D'Oliveira getting somebody hacking out of court yeah. mid-wicket. But that's a perfectly valid way to take wickets, as I say. Again, I mean, Moeen Ali didn't shine on that occasion, but Callum Ferguson did, and he was playing a little bit of the Laurie Evans role, wasn't he, which is exactly what's required.
Yeah, if you look at those three quarters that followed a similar pattern, the team that went through basically had someone who adapted to conditions well and scored a match-winning total, which was probably Keaton Jennings, who we've not really mentioned in the first game, an intelligent 46. And then Evans and Ferguson both made unbeaten 60 odds.
Both
just anchored, I think that was the advantage of chasing in all three games, really, where it was a slightly difficult pitch to read. It wasn't just to go out there and, you know, go from ball one. It was we need to work out whether this is a 130, a 140, a 150 deck. And that's the advantage of chasing, because you know what you need. And Ferguson and Evans, especially, both just sort of ticked along at the rate they knew they could very comfortably score at without taking many risks.
For the neutral, this has been one of those weeks where they've struggled to pick between teams. I've seen Lizzie Ammon of the Times has been awfully knipped from game to game, because she's saying, you know, I like Gloucestershire, I like Worcestershire, how are we going to sort it out in great Harry Hill fashion, have a fight? But I'm sort of with her there. I mean, it was a difficult one to choose between. In the end, my sympathies came down to Worcestershire for the reason that they'd never been to finals day. So it's a sort of beautiful moment for them. They are a club that, at the beginning of the season, looked like they were absolute surefire bets for relegation. They lost quite a few county championship games early on. We looked at them and thought they're going to be cannon fodder. Well, it's not turned out like that. They've won a couple of championship matches lately. They're off the foot of the table. They've got very realistic chances of staying up. And actually, it's teams like Yorkshire who looked to be in disarray. They're the ones where players are leaving left, right and centre. Jack Brooks, we've discovered this week, going off to Somerset. That's another one of the Yorkshire exodus. Worcestershire somehow are creating a lot of their own players. On Sky, they make quite a big deal about how Worcestershire are the youngest side. I don't quite think that tells the full story, because the likes of Ferguson, Moeen Ali, Brett D'Oliveira is in his mid-20s, 26, 27. They do have young players, undoubtedly, but they've got that great mix of youth and experience. Ben Cox behind the stumps, terrific keeper. But they've missed their club captain with injury. So, you know, as an achievement, it's up there, isn't it?
Yeah, I think one of the other things that Worcester have done is recruited really well in terms of overseas players. Because, you know, when you look at the Blast, there's a lot of teams that get someone in the hopes that they'll sign up for an entire tournament. They work out halfway through, we've actually got this tour that we hadn't factored in, and then you're suddenly scrambling around for a last minute replacement, have a game or two with only one or sometimes no overseas players. Whereas Worcester have admirably so far worked out the exact availabilities of who's where when, and then recruited really well. So they had Martin Guptill and Travis Head for the first 7 or 8 games of the tournament, who both did really well. I mean, Guptill started slowly and then had that unbelievable 100 against Northants. And then after that,
poor Northants. Sorry, we hadn't mentioned Northants all podcast, and I thought we might get away with it, but I'm afraid just the mere mention of it brings a small tear to my eye. Bless him. But yeah, sorry, continue.
And then Ferguson's come in, and he's a really likable character as well. He's in his late 30s. He's coming for the full season again next year, which is a good bit of business.
But he's got eyes like a panda.
Yeah,
he's got those wonderful black rings around. Like he's, you know, an insomniac.
He's been playing a lot of sort of Birmingham League cricket as well when he's there. He's playing club cricket while he's not playing for Worcestershire.
He seems to love it there, doesn't he? I mean, he talks very fondly of the environment, and he talks to himself as a Worcestershire man. Mm. I mean, he's a terrific guy to have. A proper seasoned Aussie pro to link and to meld those talents together is exactly what they require.
Yeah, it's perfect. And if he can do it in all formats for another season or two, then, you know, Worcester will look at him as a possible, everyone talks about who's your perfect overseas player, and everyone always went back to Michael Klinger for two seasons, where he was playing in all formats, scoring a lot of runs, captaining the side, and was a great presence in that Gloucestershire dressing room, and is never on international duty. And if Callum Ferguson has another couple of years in him, then he could quite feasibly do that well, that role for Worcestershire. And, you know, there's a few question marks as to who's going to captain the side. Obviously, Joe Leach has missed most of the season with injury. You know, Moeen Ali is often on England duty and is the white ball captain at the moment. So I wouldn't say it's beyond the realms of possibility that Callum Ferguson could skipper the side in a year or two.
So, yeah, Worcestershire will be absolutely delighted at how they've got on. They've finally made it through to finals day. And earlier, we caught up with one of their more seasoned pros, a man who's almost been talked about in England terms, given their rather atrocious batting travails at the moment. None other than the mighty Daryl Mitchell.
So, Daryl, a great win in Saturday's quarter-final. You obviously came on to bowl at quite an important time with Gloucestershire going pretty well after the power play. Do you feel comfortable with bowling those big overs?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I've obviously bowled quite a lot over the years in various stages of the game, I guess. But yeah, obviously, it tends to be the case at New Road, sort of get out of the power play and pace off can often work. So yeah, I was quite comfortable coming on at that point. And I think if I could have produced a pitch for my bowling, it would probably be something similar to what we had on Saturday. So yeah, no, all fortunately all worked out quite well in the end.
And the wicket of Miles Hammond was obviously the crucial one after he got off to a bit of a flyer. How pleasing was that?
Yeah, obviously that was big. They got off to a great start with him and Klinger up top. So obviously a key wicket. So I've not seen him play before. So it was quite an entertaining, not for neutral, I imagine, not so much when you stood at cover and the ball's flying over your head. But no, I thought he played really well. So it was really important we got him out soon after the power play, and fortunately we did that, and then obviously Dolly picked up wickets regularly from the other end as well.
He did, didn't he? And I mean, there was one hilarious moment when he looked genuinely embarrassed to have got a couple. He got out with the virtual double bouncer. He had a fantastic expression on his face for the cameras at that point.
Yeah, I mean, that's often the way, isn't it, in T20 cricket, I guess. You can bowl your best ball and it ends up disappearing over the stands, and then you bowl a rank long up or a half volley or a full toss even sometimes, and they tend to either miss him completely or hit him straight down somebody's throat. That's sort of the nature of the beast, I suppose. I guess the key thing is to try and keep mixing it up and hopefully force the errors from the batsman that way.
You got to finals day for the first time for Worcestershire. The club must be absolutely buzzing, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's massive for, obviously, for the players, but all the support staff, and then obviously even the office staff, groundsmen, sort of something we've been striving for a long time, and it'll be a great day out for our supporters and members as well. So yeah, it's something that you've sort of looked at from afar, keep watching it on telly every year and flicking between the games. But to be a part of it, it's going to be something special and something that we're really looking forward to.
Without wishing to tempt fate too much, where would that rank a win at Edgbaston in the final of the T20 Blast in terms of career highlights for you?
Oh, I think it'd be right up there, wouldn't it? I mean, unfortunately, for one trophy, I think we won the Pro 40 in 2007, which was probably I would class as my highlight of my career so far. But then, obviously playing promotions, we won Division 2 as well. But I think to win on a finals day at Edgbaston in front of a packed Eric Hollis stand, I think that would be right up there. But obviously, there's a lot of work to be done and a lot of good cricket to be played before that becomes a possibility.
Matt and I have been discussing the pitches for the quarterfinals. Is this just what sort of happens towards the end of the season? You know, tired pitches in the centre of the square, resulting in relatively low scoring games for three of the quarterfinals. The fourth one at Taunton, a lot of runs, but actually, you know, there's very similar patterns in those three other quarterfinals, weren't there?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, sometimes obviously the TV pitches especially tend to be used quite a lot. So I don't know if the other grounds were used pitches or not. I think our one in particular, I think it's been dry for so long, we've had some bouncing pitches in our T20, sort of 180, sort of the minimum score that you wanted to get. But then we had a lot of rain the day before, so it just felt a little bit tacky, a little bit damp around the square, and maybe even on the wicket to a degree. So I think it was just stopped in the surface a little bit longer than the ball had done in the group game. So I think that probably had a big effect at Muro, was actually the weather sort of the day before, and even the morning it was very sort of damp around the grounds, or that the outfield was quite wet in places. So, yeah, I think that was probably more to do with the weather than anything at New Road.
And in terms of being the perfect pitch for your bowling attack with yourself, Brett D'Oliveira and Moen Ali, you guys have been doing the same thing for 6 or 7 years now in the T20s, where you take pace off the ball and drag it back in the middle of the innings. Was that pretty much the perfect pitch?
Yeah, I guess so. I think it's sort of, obviously we haven't had no hell of a lot over the last couple of years in particular, and we've had some good overseas spinners as well, which have done that. I think slow bowling in that middle period tends to have been our strength in recent years. Dolly's obviously had a couple of fantastic years. I think we had Mitch Santner last year, who was our best bowler side agile before that. So yeah, spin and pace off has certainly worked for us in the past, and obviously has worked for us this year. But I think the likes of Pat Brown and Ed Barnard with their mixture of slow balls and things like that, it's also a surface that quite suits their bowling as well. So yeah, it was probably a wicket. I think in an ideal world, we'd like a slightly better wicket, maybe a 160, 170, 180 pitch that we'd been used to playing on. But as it happened, it worked out pretty well. I think our batters found it difficult second half, but fortunately we'd done enough with the balls that managed the batters to get over the line, particularly obviously Callum Ferguson with a fantastic innings.
Looking forward to the semi-final now. Is it right you're playing the first one, is that right?
Yeah, I believe so, yeah. I think Lancashire at 11 o'clock, is it, I think
so. Make sure you get there on time.
Unfortunately, it's only just down the road, isn't it? So it's not too far away for us, so it's a pretty short journey.
It is, and you know, looking forward to that. You win that game, you then get the opportunity to rest for sort of the middle part of the day. It's a very long day. How are you going to prepare for that? I mean, can you afford to sort of prepare with the final in mind? I suppose you've basically got to keep your sights on the semi.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we've got to go out to beat Lancashire at 11 o'clock on that morning, as simple as that, and then we'll worry about the rest after. I think if you lose that game, you're out and you're on your way home, aren't you? So, yeah, every energy, every focus, all the analysis will be on that semi-final. Obviously, we know Lancashire pretty well, being in the North Group, played them a lot over recent years, and obviously this year, I think we've played them a couple of times as well in white ball cricket, one in the 50 over, one in the 20-20, the other one was washed out, unfortunately. But yeah, obviously we know them quite well, but on the flip side, obviously they'll know us pretty well as well. So it's going to be an intriguing game in cricket, and all our energies have got to be focused on trying to win that one.
Are you expecting to have Moen back for finals day?
I believe so. Obviously, I guess it's up to the ECB. I think generally the England players are released, aren't they, for finals day? So I imagine if we have Mo, they'll have Josh Butler, who's a pretty good addition to their side as well. So yeah, no, I think you get to these sort of big games and semi-finals, knockout stages, you want the best players available, don't you? So hopefully we'll have Mo, they'll have Josh, and may the best team win on the day.
Just a quick tip for you there. Josh Butler looks quite vulnerable to being stumped off a wide. That might be the way to go.
That's quite fortunate, as well. I bowled quite a few of them, so that might be a good plan.
Darryl, we're going to let you go in a sec. Just one last question. Obviously, that you're fighting a potential relegation battle in the County Championship. You've got T20. It's a kind of facile question, because what you're going to want to do is stay up and win T20. But I've got to ask it, if you had one choice...
Oh, dear.
I'm sorry about that. I know it's a really annoying question, but I'm only giving you one. What's it to be?
Well, I'm not going to sit on the fence. Obviously you want both, but I think I'd take the trophy every time. I think I've won one trophy in 14 years. It'd be nice to make it two. So a win at finals day would be pretty special. And like I say, you don't get that many opportunities to win trophies and win competitions. So it's certainly something I'm excited about and looking forward to the opportunity to have that on the 15th.
Darryl, on that massively positive note, I should say, we're going to let you get on with preparations for your County Championship game.
Brilliant. Thank you very much.
So in all seriousness, how do we think Worcester are going to get on against Lancashire? They're playing, we know this, in the second semi-final. The first semi-final. They are playing the first semi-final. Because there was talk that it was going to be Sussex in that first semi-final, which I thought was a bit unfair on the denizens of Hove to have to make it all the way up to Edgbaston for 11 o'clock. So Worcestershire, Lancashire, the two North Group representatives, will play in that first semi-final. Where's your money on that one? Because I would say that the sort of favourites for finals day, which we'll come on to in a minute, are actually in the second semi-final, aren't they?
I'm erring towards Worcestershire in the first one, I think. I think Lancashire are probably going to end up being too reliant on either Butler or returning pitch. I can see them having a terrible low score first up. I can see their bowling attack not being seated to a really flat wicket and getting belted out the park. I think from a romantic point of view as well, it would be lovely, wouldn't it, if Worcester got to a first ever, not only their first ever finals day, but if they made it as far as the final.
With 100 from Moeen Ali, something like that.
Yeah.
You know, especially at Edgbaston, because there's always been so much talk about Moeen Ali going to Warwickshire, going to Birmingham as well, one and the same, of course, the Birmingham Bears. And he hasn't. He stayed loyal to Worcester throughout, which is a testament to him. And it would be kind of lovely, wouldn't it, if he could lead them into a final. That would be superb.
And in terms of a sort of club point of view, obviously you've had Kev Sharp. He's done such a great job there this year. And it would be, I think, for people like Daryl Mitchell, Ben Cox, Brett D'Oliveira, all these guys who have been there, they've had various promotions to cheer about, but in terms of a real seminal moment for that generation of players,
and who's
to say?
And it'd be kind of the theme of this year's tournament as well, wouldn't it? Because, you know, there's a lot of talk about the 100 in the background coming in 2 years' time. And so these counties that are not going to be hosting teams for that tournament, we know pretty much for sure that they won't be. Mm-hmm. To see them doing well it's not sticking two fingers up at the ECB, far from it, but it is sort of, it's been a little bit of the theme of this Vitality Blast this year, that the sides from the big grounds have mostly not made it. Now, Lancashire are the one exception to that. We've got to move on to the fourth and final quarterfinal, because it was probably the most, it was the one drenched with the most runs, it was the one drenched with the most rain as well. It was scheduled for the Sunday, they had a sellout. And then the rains came, and my word, they really did come. It was horrible. It was a grim, horrible grey day. But mercifully, they have reserve days for quarterfinals. So they got the game on Monday. Difference being, on this occasion, of course, that the Sky TV cameras were down at Hove for Women's Super League Finals Day. So it was televised only online, I suppose. So you got to see that. I didn't, because I was on commentary. This is one of the great things that's been happening in the last few years, is that counties have got cameras at all their grounds, but there were only, two cameras, one at each end and then sort of one wide angle? No, it wasn't even a wide angle. So the four catches that Max Waller took on the deep mid-wicket boundary are only visible to the crowd and the press who were there on the day.
Yeah, I mean, it was a slightly strange spectacle in that it kind of lost some of the glitz and glamour of a quarterfinal, but equally I think it kind of suited this year's tournament. As we were saying, it's quite often been the unfashionable teams who have made it through to the quarterfinals, and it kind of fits the Somerset bill perfectly, that, you know, the only way to watch them, which I believe a record number of people did.
Did they break the streaming record?
I think so. I'm unconfirmed as yet, but I think so.
I mean, you'd imagine, because they're a very passionate bunch, the Somerset crowd.
Yeah, you know, exactly.
They've got a great history in, what used to be Red Bull one-day matches back in the 70s and 80s. The fact that they sold it out, and it was a bank holiday Monday, so I dare say a fair few of the crowd came in. Were you able to gauge that from the cameras? That's been quite tricky, actually.
I think they... Basically, there was a little bit of question. There were a few question marks as to whether the tickets would still be valid. They were still valid. There were a few people, and a word probably to poor Ben, who was running the Somerset social media accounts, who was inundated with messages throughout the weekend on Twitter and Facebook.
He was very patient. He was very patient with me as well, because I was asking lots of inane questions on the way down on the train.
But yeah, I think they had 7,500, which is a good Taunton crowd.
Terrific.
And were rewarded with a pretty entertaining game of cricket, really.
And we got to talk about Lewis Gregory, because, he's my man of the week. It's a bit unfair of me to take him as man of the week, because it doesn't leave you with any real contenders. What did he get? 60 off 24, an unbeaten 60 off 24 balls. And there was a time in that Somerset innings when they actually looked like they might limp to no more than 160, 170. But they went absolutely berserk. The last, five and a half overs yielded over 80 runs. Quite extraordinary stuff. It meant that there were some relatively ropey bowling figures at the other end, including a couple of corkers. Dan Christian, 1.1 overs, none for 21, sticks out. But you have one that you prefer we'll come on to ropey bowling figures slightly later, because that means going back. But Dan Christian bowled that 1.1 overs because Harry Gurney had to be whipped out of the attack. He got the above waist high two delivery warning and out, didn't he?
He did. It was a very strange innings, actually, the first one, because it kind of followed the pattern that a lot of Somerset's innings have batting first this tournament, which is that they fall foul of what is a slightly, I think, outdated adage in T20 cricket, which is if you lose three wickets in a power play, you almost always lose. And I think that Somerset have kind of proved that this is, that as a rule only really works on the assumption that teams bat down to six or seven, because Somerset this year have had Corey Anderson at number six, Lewis Gregory, who's been probably the finisher of the tournament, at seven, Roelof van der Merwe, who's a really good white ball player, at number eight. And basically what's happened has been they go quite hard in the power play, but quite often end up something ridiculous like 55 for three off six. Then James Hildreth and Tom Abel rotate the strike and everyone thinks, well, they're going to limp to 150, 160. But actually, because of the fact that those two stay in, knock the ball around, the bowling team takes their foot off the gas a bit, they then set up a position where Anderson, Gregory and van der Merwe especially, as a trio, can come in with seven or eight overs to go, licensed to swing, and know that 200 is pretty much in their sights from anywhere. I mean, if you look at, Anderson was out 14.3 overs in with the score 128. That suggests 170 would be a pretty good total, and they got 209.
Yeah, and 209, it was, I think, always going to be too much. I mean, Nottingham should got off to a good start. Alex Hales, did he hit four consecutive boundaries before getting out? The wicket fell early, but when you've got someone like Hales, any target is achievable. But I'm afraid, I've got to say, as a neutral, I was rooting for Somerset. They were just the team I wanted to go through. I'm sort of delighted. I also wanted two representatives from the South Group, two from the North Group. It's kind of lovely. And the way the semi-finals have worked out, it guarantees one from each, doesn't it? Because Sussex is going to be playing Somerset in that quarter-final. I think that could be a really intriguing one, because it's a battle between a fantastic bowling attack and, of the four sides left, the most explosive batting lineup. And actually, I think Somerset had, if not the, just behind Surrey, the highest run rate in the league stage. So they're a side that's used to, for all the reasons that you've been saying, used to scoring a lot of runs. That's going to be a really interesting test of the theory. Is it the bowlers that are going to win out, or the batters? I could look like a real chump at the end of finals, though.
Well, the game at Hove between those two teams was a real thriller earlier in this competition, where Somerset pulled off quite a remarkable run chase of, I think, 192 or something like that. Mm. It was a really high-scoring thriller. Went right down to the last over or two. I think Jamie Overton struck the winning runs, batting at 9 or 10. And if it's a repeat of that, I think we're in for a treat, really, because I think Somerset are probably a team that prefers chasing, but have been pretty good both chasing and defending this tournament. They've only lost three games, I think. Whereas Sussex, you'd probably say, do you think marginally prefer chasing?
I think they do marginally. I mean, because they've got somebody like Laurie Evans, they can pace the chase around, and they like to know what score they've got to get, in large part because they're not the sort of side that are going to go, or are comfortable going, really large with the bat early on, you know. So if they know they need 150, that sort of plays into their strengths. I think that's going to be that could be the game of finals day for me. Whoever gets through that is going to be my favourite to win, I think. At the moment, I don't know. Well, so let's come to predictions after we've done some naming and shaming, because with only four games this week, there are fewer to choose from, and not very many poor bowling performances, I'm afraid, because there were six innings that didn't accrue more than 143 runs out of the eight. We've mentioned Dan Christian's 21 in seven balls. We mentioned Harry Gurney's none for 36 in 2.5. Jofra Archer, fabulous player, don't get me wrong, but one for 40 this week, which relatively stand out. But my favourite is, and you've got a stat on this, which I really like, Jamie Overton's figures, four overs, five for 47. What is unusual about that?
It was the second most expensive five-wicket haul in T20 history.
Second most? Who's got the most?
It was a no-name person in a small Indian T20 league who took five for 52 two or three years back, but
right.
whose name has escaped you.
But 5 for 47 is pretty impressive. A lot of them, as we've discovered, caught on the mid-wicket boundary, apparently quite well, according to David Hobbs's match report.
Yeah.
So he was he was one of the people witnessing it. Thank God we had like four eyes watching it. You yeah. watching on the feed online, and Hopsy keeping his old grizzled eyes alert to whatever was happening in the field. Who else have we got? Jerome Taylor, 1 for 43 or 4, is another one that took my fancy. And Stephen Mullaney. I mean, all the best bowling figures are coming from that match, the Somerset Notts game. Normally so parsimonious, as Jeremy Coney would say. 2 overs, 1 for 29. So those are our named and shamed bowlers of the week. Our leggy watch, 3 for 27 from Matt Parkinson, we've mentioned. Zahir Khan, I'm counting him as a leggy because he's left arm leggy. 1 for 28. Joe Denley, 1 for 30. Will Beard, 2 for 17. Brett D'Oliveira, 4 for 26. And an honourable mention for Danny Briggs, is 2 for 19. I know he's not a leggy, but he's a spinner. Those are my standout bowling performances, as well as Wayne Parnell, who's proving to be very handy indeed. He could prove to be a crucial player on finals day. But man of the week's got to go to Lewis Gregory, I think, for the unbeaten 60 and 2 for 29. I mean, he just gives that side so much, doesn't he? And you could see him being the man of finals day.
Yeah, I was trying to find someone to argue. I was trying to find someone to pick who I could argue the case for, but it's very difficult to actually find anyone. I was looking at just a crunch of numbers on Gregory. He's currently, for the tournament, has 321 runs from 148 balls.
Whoa. So that's a strike rate of well over 200.
217. He's faced the fewest dot balls out of any batsman. So 1 in 5 balls he faces, he fails to score off.
And that's really important, because yesterday, or whenever it was, the game was 5 sixes, 2 fours. So he got 38 runs in boundaries, but he got 22 runs off the remaining 13 balls. So, you know, I always think that that's a percentage that's not taken into account anything like enough.
Yeah, and then as well as that, he also has the fewest balls per boundary stat, so 3.1.
He's got a lot!
A boundary every 3.14 balls. His strike rate after 5 balls of the innings is 171, so it's not like he takes any time getting set. And to be honest, you know, Gregory is probably a guy who, because of the fact that he's 26, 27, is considered by most to be a bowler who can fling a bat at it, is a guy who's not really going to be considered by England and probably won't be considered by too many T20 franchise leagues. But realistically, this sort of tournament he's having, you know, that he's probably the standout finisher in this tournament.
Yeah, well, it's virtually impossible to argue with those stats. That is extraordinary. And actually, I really love your first 5 ball stat, because that is an important one, especially if you're going to come in down the order. You can't afford to be chewing up many balls down there. So, we've got some honourable mentions, obviously, for Laurie Evans' 63 and Delray Rawlins' 42 off 29. Callum Ferguson, we've mentioned, had a good week. James Hildreth with 52 off 28. And Tom Abel anchoring with an unbeaten 46 off 30. So we've got our four finalists. 15th of September, it's going to be, well, it might not be freezing cold. The forecast is actually for high pressure to build from the beginning of September. You never know, we might get an Indian summer yet. It jolly well needs to, though, because 15th September's late, and if we thought that was late, next year's going to be even later because of the Ashes. I think it's the 22nd or something of September. It's like the autumnal equinox it's going to be. And it's a long, long day, is finals day. It's a test of stamina for everybody, players, fans. A lot of the fans don't make it through to the end. We will be reporting from that. Do not worry. This is not the last talking T20 of the season. But I want your predictions, because obviously David Hopps' ones have proved to be abysmal. So let's get the roll of predictions for finals day. Let's start with that first semi-final, Worcestershire against Lancashire.
Worcestershire, I think.
I think I'm going to go with you on that. I'm going to go Worcestershire and then Sussex, Somerset.
My head says Sussex, but I'll go with my heart, which says Somerset.
Of course. Well, I'm going to go with Sussex. And presumably, your heart's also going to choose Somerset to win it, is it?
I think so. I think it has to, really. I'll back them.
Well, if they do win, it'll be spectacular. I'm still sticking with Sussex like I have from the beginning of the season. I'm claiming that now. I certainly did last week. So those are our predictions. Matt Rawlins for Somerset, I'm for Sussex. Now, I'm going to update you on what happened in the Kier Super League finals day yesterday. Did you manage to catch any of it?
Yeah, I watched the final, most of.
Well, Lizelle Lee in the final. We'll come to the final in a second, because at the first match, Lizelle Lee got a pretty handy 19. She is a woman, actually, who does have a high dot ball percentage, but she has a very high boundary percentage as well. Surrey looked like they'd blown it. Last year, you may recall, on finals day, they limped to 100 against the Western Storm, and they were easily defeated, much to the infuriation of Ebony Rainford-Brent, their director of cricket. This year it looked like a similar thing may happen. They'd succumbed to 72 for 5, and then a quite fantastic partnership, an unbeaten partnership of 90 between the South African Marizan cap and the Surrey captain Nat Siver, who finished with an unbeaten 70-odd, got them up to 162, which is chaseable in women's cricket, but it's on the outer reaches of chaseability. They looked, the Western Storm, like they were going to do it. A fabulous partnership, again, this time between Heather Knight and Fran Wilson, but was broken. Sophia Dunkley did a bit of a Brett D'Oliveira, actually. She sort of virtually double-bounced England captain Heather Knight, who played a big swish, as you do, as you see the short ball coming down. Swish, miss, hit the base middle stump, very, very similar dismissal. And what then followed was, I'm afraid, that the Western Storm were incapable of getting Fran Wilson back on strike. So 9 balls were chewed up by Naomi Dattani, the left-hander at one end, and then when she was out, more balls were chewed up. And Surrey ended up winning that game by 9 runs. Come the final against the top of the table, Loughborough.
With their mighty bowling attack as well.
With their mighty bowling attack indeed, and with Sophie Devine. But Sophie Devine picked up an injury in the field, fielding a fiercely crunched cover drive, which had her in some distress. Surrey absolutely nailed that final, though, against Loughborough. Lizelle Lee scoring 104 in 58 balls. It was absolutely matchless. I mean, there had been no sixes in the first game. She herself hit 6 sixes in that final. Took Surrey up to 183. It was, you felt, always going to be too much for Loughborough. They didn't make the most of the last 3 overs or so, Surrey, but they just took the game away, really. That partnership, again, Nat Siver shining, hitting 40. And there was I mean, it was, I was going to say a damn skip, but it wasn't really, because we'd had so much entertainment in the first match and so much entertainment in the first innings. It was just, a bit of a shame for what was a large crowd that there was an inevitability, wasn't there, didn't you think, to Loughborough's demise?
Yeah, I mean, I think what Surrey basically showed over the course of the tournament, which is true in all T20, is how important it is to time your winning run. Because, you have the same in the Blast this year with teams like Sussex and Lancashire who have got through with a series of wins. You know, Surrey had some pretty abysmal performances in the group stage. They were bowled out for, 83 and 66 in a couple of games?
Yeah.
And I saw a tweet that said their average score in the first innings before finals day was 120. Their average score was 123. They were put into bat twice and no team has ever won chasing on KSL finals day before. Had everyone defending on KSL finals day, and they managed to do so twice, and I think probably showed how important it is to keep havoc, to have a really long batting lineup.
I'm with you absolutely there. The difference between Surrey and every other team in the tournament actually was that when they were 5 down, you still felt that they could score runs, and that's not true of a lot of the sides in KSL. Once they go 5 down, then you've got an end open. If you can keep that batter on strike, you can actually go through that tail. Surrey have got strength in depth. Another really telling stat is they played 6 matches against Western Storm and Loughborough, who are the 2 standout sides in the group stage. They won 5 of them. Mm-hmm. So when they had to, and when they were playing against the better teams, they were terrific. When they were bad, they were very, very bad. When they were good, they were quite magnificent. And it was a really joyous occasion, actually. Could have done with being a little bit warmer, but Hove, I think, had the largest of the crowds for finals day, which is an upward trend that continues to improve. What we will be looking out for is to see how T20 will survive come the 100, because for women, there isn't really a county tournament that can take the place. At the moment, the Vitality Blast is expected to take place for men's counties in the earlier part of the season in 2020, and then have this 100 tournament for women. If you take the KSL out and turn that into a 100-ball game, how might that affect England internationally, because really KSL is that stepping stone between from domestic cricket to international cricket, and you take that away and you make them play 100 balls. It also seems sort of unnecessary given that women's T20s do get bowled at quite a lick. I mean, you know, you get through an innings in an hour and 10, hour and 15 minutes, no trouble at all. You're never worrying about the cut-off time. So it sort of feels to me like it's unnecessary, but same token, how do they do a 100 ball men's tournament and then brand the women's tournament as 100, but they have them playing 20 overs? It seems to me like we've created a problem that we didn't need to, but that conversation is again for another time. So congratulations to the Surrey Stars on winning. Congratulations to everybody, Rainford, Brent. Matt, we will be back, I'm not quite sure when, presumably with a full review of finals day next week. And then we're going to have to, well, I'll tell you what we're going to do, what we're thinking of doing on finals day, and this could be quite exciting, listeners. We might actually do the podcast as a kind of in real time at the end of each match on finals day. So on the 15th of September, you've got to be ready for that, I'm afraid. You're going to have to do your tapping, you have to do your match reports, and then you have to shoot into the box with me and Hopsy, discuss that game, look forward to the next one, and then we'll have real-time predictions that we cannot gainsay. What we'll have said will be in the can, and there'll be no getting away from it.
Not that anyone would have accused you of occasionally tweaking your prediction, Norky.
No, never. Never. That's not my style. Matt Roller, thanks ever so much for joining us, and I hope you've enjoyed today's podcast. From me, Daniel Norcross, until the next time.
Thank you very much. See you then.
Goodbye.
You are listening to ESPN Crick Info.